All right, so let's go ahead and get started. Presentations are coming up. We don't actually have much more in the way of lectures, relatively little after Thanksgiving. But the last three classes I'm dedicating to your presentations. There'll be two per class, and I need the groups to send me an ordered list of when you'd like to give them. So, and I'll do my best to accommodate you. If you all six want to go on the ninth, that won't work. But that actually often turns out not to be the case because you have other things going on too. So anyway, let me know what you want to do. Any questions about that? Actually, one of the things I need to do is to send you the evaluation sheet so you see the criteria that you're using to evaluate each other's projects. Okay, so last time we really started looking at the implications of Maxwell's equations, and in particular we took Maxwell's equations in differential form and we used a couple of vector calculus identities, and we took the fact that Maxwell's equations basically have Faraday's law and Ampere's law mix E and B in the differential equations, and we used calculus vector calculus identities to sort of untangle those and get these two simultaneous wave equations in B and E. And these are very much like mechanics wave equations that you've seen in the past. And they are coupled equations because although we've sort of decoupled them to create an equation in B and an equation in E alone, they aren't truly decoupled because we have all these relationships between E and B that hold true all the time. So what we have are coupled wave equations in E and B, and when we look at the interrelatedness between the two, we find, these are wave equations, so we have harmonic wave solutions to these. And we can now ask what we can learn from these. And we implemented boundary conditions, the boundary conditions being initially that we're very far away and that we assume that the electric field is a function of x and t alone. And then a little later on, we actually assumed that that the electric field is along the y direction, when early on we show that E has no longitudinal component if you're far away. It's one of the things that changes when you're very close. You can actually get longitudinal components to the fields. But very far away, we have this transverse wave picture, which is what we're looking at now. And this orientation of E in the transverse plane, well, the orientation of E in the electromagnetic wave is known as the polarization. And we'll talk a lot more about that as this class goes on. So in looking at these solutions last time, we found that both E and B are transverse. They're mutually perpendicular. They are in phase. And the relative magnitude is related by this, that the magnitude of E is equal to C times the magnitude of B. Okay? So all of this basically follows from Maxwell's equations when we put in these boundary conditions. Any questions about any of that? So the picture that comes to mind that we've sort of brought out is that we can assume that E is a function of x and t, and that E is along the y direction. And there will be, E will have some sort of maximum amplitude as it propagates, and then that it is a harmonic function in both position and time, and the position is periodic with this wave number k. So since it's periodic in position, this is 2 pi over lambda, so that every time you go a new wavelength and distance, you start the solution over again. That's what you mean by harmonic. It is harmonic in time with the frequency omega, 2 pi over the period, and Phi here is always good to have there because that tells you the initial conditions. But if you assume this solution for E, which is consistent with all the stuff that we just said, then B is mutually perpendicular, so B will have to be and transverse, which means B has to be along the Z. It's in phase, so if you have a phase angle here, it's the same here. And the magnitude goes as 1 over C times E, which you can also write as K over omega. So that's effectively, this is 2 pi over the period, and this is 2 pi over the wavelength. So that'll be, this should be 1 over C. Yeah, B is 1 over C times E. Okay, so to visualize this, then we can take the harmonic function for E, and the amplitude here for E is going to be this E0y, and the amplitude for B is this thing, which basically is this divided by C. Of course, C is a huge number, so obviously I'm not doing this to scale. E then oscillates harmonically up and down in the y direction. And as if we were to freeze time and walk along the wave, what you would see then is in the plane of the YZ, at this position, you would see E being very strong and in the Y direction everywhere in this plane, which is deceptive when you draw this envelope of the harmonic function because it's not confined transversely in the way that we're looking at it. And as we walk then along the wave, we walk along to the point where the electric field is zero. When the electric field is big, when we're back at this origin, the B field is also big. So in this plane, you have a strong electric field here, a strong B field here, if we've frozen time. As we now walk along the wave, these are zero, and then they oscillate the other direction, okay? And then they come back to zero, and then they go like this. They're always perpendicular to one another. If we're standing here, and our eyeball is detecting this stuff as it comes into our eyeball at the speed of light, you're going to see the electric field oscillating up and down, and the magnetic field oscillating side to side as this comes through your eyeball. And what you'll see again as the thing comes through, if we imagine we start right over here where we have an electric field that's high and a magnetic field like that, as it now flies through your eyeball, you'll see these vectors doing this, right, as if you could visualize it as it goes flying through your eye. And I have that Java applet that I put on the web, which is sort of nice to look at, I think, fun to play with. Any questions on the solution that we're looking at? This intuition, I mean, this picture will serve you well for most of what you're dealing with light and electromagnetic waves. If you get very close to the source, if you have this wave propagating in what's called a waveguide, so if you make a conducting pipe and you put the wave inside that, if you're worrying about how the waves look inside of resonant cavities like microwaves or things like that, this picture won't really serve you well because you can have longitudinal components and things like that. So just be aware of that. It's not something we're going to be doing in our class, but just be aware it exists. Any questions about the basic picture? Okay, so the next thing I'd like to do is to actually look at energy flow in the wave, because if you're standing there and this wave is passing through you, it has electric and magnetic fields. And even though we started out sort of creating the field as this sort of mathematical entity that we created for convenience, we've now discovered that they carry energy. And so the electromagnetic wave carries energy. Why do you care? Do you care? You better care, right? It would, as cold as it is out here, as cold as it is in here, it would be a lot colder if electromagnetic waves did not carry energy. Huh?
Like Alaska.
It'd be worse than Alaska. It would be far worse. And we've said, we've... In this picture with Maxwell, there's some assumption that there's actually a medium in which these waves travel. And the reason for that is up until the discovery of electromagnetic waves, the only waves that were known were mechanical waves. So the idea was that there is some medium that we don't really know about, we don't understand, but it must be there because that's how waves work. We'll call it the ether because we don't notice it when we go walking around. And the electric and magnetic waves must be oscillating within this medium. So that was sort of the picture when Maxwell first came out with it. And that didn't get overthrown until the early 1900s with the invention of relativity. But at that point, there comes the realization that electric and magnetic waves can actually move through a vacuum very nicely. So we have all this energy coming from the sun directly to us, and it's coming through the vacuum through electromagnetic waves. So your corn grows because you have energy incident on it that gets converted into all the various biological crud that turns into corn, right? So it's very important to us that electromagnetic waves carry energy. So what I want to do is to actually think about the energy flow. So let's imagine that we have a wave that is propagating in the x direction, so pretty much the solution that we just came up with. And we said that if E is in the y, then B is in the z. So at some given point in this, we can say that. And so this wave is moving along, and what I'd like to do is to actually take a sliver of space transverse to the direct propagation of this wave and basically ask how much energy is incident through that box. So hopefully you can get the idea of what I'm trying to draw. This basically a thin box, some sort of plane, right? And we want to ask how much energy flows through this box. So the plane wave is propagating this way. So at any given point in this plane wave, or certainly as a function of time, I have time-varying electric and magnetic fields. So we can take what we know about electric and magnetic fields and consider this. The energy density in the electric field is epsilon naught over 2 times the magnitude of E squared at any given moment, right? And the energy in the magnetic field is equal to 1 over 2 mu naught times the magnitude of the magnetic field squared. So if we were to ask how much energy differentially, so let's take this little differential sliver of the wave, then du in the box, so we'll call this the energy in the box is going to be equal to the electric field density plus the magnetic field density times the volume of the box. Okay, basically integrate over those densities. Although, since it's a differential thickness, we don't have to worry about the fact that they're changing in strength at that moment. So dU is equal to epsilon naught over 2 times E squared plus 1 over 2 mu naught times B squared, so that's the sum of the energy densities, times the area, the cross-sectional area of the box, times dx, which is the differential thickness of the box. And we'll say we have cross-sectional area. You okay with this? All right. It's not particularly useful to ask what is the energy in the box at a given moment, because this wave is traveling through it at the speed of light. So what's actually more interesting is to ask what is the power, right? How much energy per unit time is passing through this box? Or if I had a surface that was absorbing all of the light, for example, how much power does it absorb? Right, how much energy per unit time hits that area and is absorbed. So let's look at the power. dU over dt is going to, and I'm going to pull the area over. So I'm going to start out with this. I'm going to divide by time, dU over dt, and pull area over. Okay, I'm skipping a step here that I want to back up and look at carefully. C is equal to dx over dt. So when I take the time derivative of this piece, this becomes C, okay? And we know that E is equal to C times B. So we can pull C in here, and C times B becomes E. And there's also the relationship that 1 over the square root of epsilon naught mu 0 is equal to C. So when we use that information, we can rewrite this quantity in terms of, see if I actually have it done cleaner. Yeah, that's what I wanted to do. Sorry, let me slow down, because it's actually good to see how all this fits together. All right, so we're going to start with this, and now I want to take advantage of the fact that E is equal to C times B, epsilon naught is equal to 1 over mu 0 C squared, which is using the relationship that we saw earlier, that C is equal to 1 over the root epsilon naught mu 0. So now dU is equal to, I'm going to rewrite the epsilon naught, so this is 1 over 2 mu naught C squared. So the 2 comes directly down, and then I'm taking epsilon naught and rewriting it in terms of this. And this then is equal to E. And we're going to rewrite the other E as C times B. So this is equivalent to this term. And now we're going to rewrite the second term. So we have the 1 over 2 mu naught. And then we're going to rewrite one of the B's as E over C. And then this whole thing is times the area times dx. Okay? Now we're going to say that du in energy moves dx in a time dt. It's dx over c, right, in time dt. Because it's moving at the speed of light. So du is equal to 1 over, so I can take these two terms, which are now identical, right, and I have a 1 over 2 and a 1 over 2, so I just combine them into a 1. So I have 1 over mu 0 times c times E times B times the area times dx. Du over dt times 1 over the area is equal to 1 over mu naught times c times e times b, and now I have moved the area down and I've divided by it, so this is dx over dt, which is c. So I should have the power, this quantity, the power per unit area is equal to E times B divided by mu naught. And this is in watts per meter squared. The power per unit area is a quantity that's known as the intensity. That's what you perceive as the brightness of the light, if it's something that your eye can perceive. Yeah? Yeah, that's what you hear is the intensity of the sound. And this is what's really important, because there may be times you have to worry about instantaneous energy deposition or something from some wave, but what's generally important is it's moving at the speed of light, so you want to know how much energy is incident per area per time. That's what decides, that's what determines theoretically how much corn you can grow, right? If you know the efficiency of the corn to convert that energy into something useful, right? The limit to how much you could actually do is determined by how much energy is incident per unit area over time. So that's basically the intensity of light that's important. So another way to, I think of this as energy flux. Okay with that? All right. We can put this in terms of E or B, because you've seen that with this E is equal to CB, it's easy to go back and forth. But one of the things that's interesting here is that this power is actually flowing in some direction. The energy is actually flowing in the direction of the wave. So if E is up and B is this way, which comes from the Maxwell's equations, the energy is flowing that way because the waves are propagating that way. And so you can determine the direction of the energy flow by looking at E cross B, right? If I put my fingers along E, curl into B, my thumb goes in the direction that the wave is propagating. So the energy is actually propagating that way. So we're going to create something a little bit new, which is like a power vector, an energy vector, which we call the pointing vector. And I've actually forgotten the source of pointing. It may be a person. But it's sort of a nice word because although it's spelled incorrectly, it points in the direction that the energy is flowing. So it's sort of easy to remember. So it typically has a symbol S, and it is equal to E cross B over mu naught. If you need to determine the energy, you don't need to put this in terms of E and B. You can write this in terms of E squared or B squared. It doesn't matter because this is just a power. But if you want to think about the direction, E cross B gives you the direction. Okay? You also may see this written differently because mu can be converted to epsilon naught. So it can be nice and confusing. You can get used to this equation and then go to your book and see an equation that looks vaguely familiar, except there's no mu naught. It's done in terms of epsilon naught and C. I mean, so just be aware that different books will look at it in different ways. All right. So pointing vector. Because E and B are both varying with time. If we want to look at we can talk about the instantaneous pointing vector, which is the instantaneous energy per meter squared that's being deposited, basically. But it's the time average that's actually pretty important, generally. So we know that E and B vary with time. So that means that the magnitude of S also varies. E varies sinusoidally, so E goes as E naught times the sine of omega t. If that's how E is varying, the magnitude of E is varying, B varies with the same harmonic phase, and it goes as E naught over C times the sine of omega t. And that means that the magnitude of S will go as E naught squared times sine of squared omega t divided by mu zero times C. Just substituting in here, the mu zero comes straight down, and then you have the E, one of the E, the magnitude of E is one of these E sine omega. Magnitude of B is E sine omega divided by C. So that's where the C comes in. And now we can actually time average the sine, and the time average of sine squared is 1/2. So if we look at the average intensity, sorry, this is not a vector. This is an S with a bar. The bar is not one of my vectors or what my vectors sort of look like sometimes. Okay. In fact, I will usually call this, I'll use what is often quantum mechanical notation. It's sort of the average S, the time average of S, is E0 squared over 2 times mu naught C. We can rewrite it in terms of B, C over 2 mu naught times b squared, or you can put it in terms of E and B, right? So this represents the time average intensity, which is a very relevant thing for most uses. Check something here. Yeah, this would be a CB naught. There is, I believe, you may get confusion. Something is ringing a bell in my ear, in my head. It's either your textbook or it's the one that was used by Physics 114 last year. I can't remember which. They'll use the RMS electric field, and it leads to a slightly different equation. It's sort of the same thing, but just be cautious about that. And it can lead to some confusion because a problem is asked that looks at it from the other point of view. So just be aware of that. All right, you okay with the pointing vector? All right. This stuff is important, so. All right, so now let's think about, let's say we have an electromagnetic wave plugging along the x direction, the way we've had. And what I'd like to do is to think for a moment about what would happen if you had a charge sitting on the x-axis. So just a little plus Q is sitting right here. And we have this wave passing through, so at one moment we have an electric field like that, and we have a magnetic field like that. What's going to happen instantaneously? I mean, this is going to be, we're going to sort of talk instantaneously because I want to think about how A and B are oriented this way, but of course it won't make a lot of sense because this charge, you have inertia, but let's assume for a moment that this is almost massless, so it moves almost instantaneously. If E is going up, there will be a force on this charge up. So this charge will begin to move up. So once it gets a velocity moving up, right, V cross B will give us a force going along X. If a moment later the electromagnetic wave has now gone from this to that, okay, the charge will have a force on it down. It can have a velocity going down, curl in the B, gives you a force out this way. So it turns out that as the electromagnetic wave is passing this charge, it will actually exert a force on the charge, pushing it out. Sort of cool. So I want to look at this for a moment. And we're going to look at it instantaneously. So I want to ask, what is the change in the momentum on the charge with respect to time, which of course is what we know as the force in the x direction. So this is going to be Q times V cross B in the x, which if we go and we do V cross B and ask what is the x component, we get that this is Q times V in the y, B in the z, minus V in the z, B in the y. And we have no B in the Y, so this term is zero. So dP in the X with respect to time is equal to the charge times V in the Y times B in the Z. We can convert this to E by, this is the same as, it's a magnitude thing, right? Because we're looking at just the X component. So this is Q over C times V in the Y times E in the Y, because we use that B in the Z is equal to E in the Y over C. You okay? So let's do a little bit of dimensional analysis. What is work? That goes as force dotted into distance. The force that's on this particle goes as Q times E. Times the distance, and then I'm going to divide by time and multiply by time, and this piece then will go as the velocity. So if we look at the differential work with respect to time, then we get something that looks like Q times E dotted into V. But that's the same thing as QVY times EY, which is what we've just seen up here. So all I'm really trying to do is to show that this QVY EY piece is basically power. Okay? So the force in the X goes as dP in the X with respect to time is 1 over C times the power. Which means that the differential momentum change goes as 1 over C times sort of the energy flow. So we can look at, as strange as it seems, because we haven't talked about masses, electromagnetic waves carry momentum because they can actually cause momentum change in these particles. So the momentum in an electromagnetic wave goes as the energy in the electromagnetic wave divided by C. Little bit of hand waving in here, but are you okay with that? Does that seem plausible? All right, so let us assume that we have an electromagnetic wave that's incident on a surface and it gets absorbed. All right, we've just said it carries momentum. So let's ask what happens when it gets absorbed. The force we know is dP over dT, and that's by definition of force. So that's going to be dU over dT times 1 over C for the electromagnetic wave, because P is equal to U over C. So this is going to be the energy per area per time multiplied by the area. I'm just going to take this and multiply it by area divided by area.